High resolution color graphics.
This land of high technology.
The revolution in technology that made the information age possible.
Those kids are not afraid of computers.
Welcome to This Week in Retro for the week of August 3rd, 2020. Coming up on today's show,
the Analog Pocket handheld sells out in only 15 minutes.
The PowerKitty Q90 offers a far cheaper alternative, but is it in the same league?
Myst gets an 8-bit demake.
A new sampler lands for the Amiga.
The co-creator of the Humble Mouse has passed away.
And Elite Hyperspaces on to the Vectrex.
All this and more on This Week in Retro. Up-to-date news
for out-of-date tech.
Our first story this week is that the Analog Pocket has gone up for pre-orders and it's sold out in less than 15 minutes. So if you don't know what this is, John, the Analog Pocket is a new handheld device which developers Analog describe as a multi-video game system portable handheld and also a digital audio workstation with a built-in synth and sequencer. There's a lot going on in this thing.
Wow.
It features two FPGA chips which sit inside a slim Game Boy-style case with cores for the Game Boy, Game Boy Color, Game Boy Advance. They come as standard, but it also supports the Game Gear Neo Geo Pocket Color, Atari Lynx, and unspecified more, in quotes, with additional purchased adapters. So I think they've got plans to support more systems in the future. So it's an interesting little system. I don't know if you've seen it and what your first impressions were, John.
I think that this is one of these things. I lump this in with the Retro NT and a bunch of these kind of new initiatives to employ real hardware and, or, I'm sorry, real carts into FPGA hardware. So this is for the people that want to have that tactile sensation of putting a cartridge into a system and also skirts around the legal quote-unquote gray area of emulation. So I'm a fan of these things. They are definitely not for the empty of wallet, though.
They've specifically said that it doesn't natively support ROM, so you can't just download games and dump them on there. Of course, you can get around that with a cartridge with an SD card slot in there, like you would on the original hardware. But their goal is to create something as authentic as possible, as true to the original hardware as possible, using FPGA chips. And when I saw they were using FPGA, my first impression was this is going to be expensive, but it's $199 in a black or a white casing. And that swung me. I think that's actually a pretty good price.
I agree with you because I believe that there are some FPGA-based retro systems that are easily double that price. I want to say that the latest edition of whatever plays the Nintendo Entertainment System games is about double that. I think it's knocking on around $500. So I think a $200 for an FPGA system that has the kind of flexibility that this thing has isn't a bad deal.
But on the flip side, you've got to remember it's natively supporting a Game Boy, a Game Boy Color, and a Game Boy Advance. These are not powerful systems. So there will be the argument that you could have just do the same thing with a Raspberry Pi or a cheap ARM processor. But this is catering to the premium market. There are enough Famiclones, there are enough cheap handhelds coming out of China to cater for those people. This is a premium product, and it really looks it in the product design. I would personally have liked to have seen wider system support. So there's a dock that you can buy for $100 with HDMI output, and it also charges it. Now, I would love to have seen this have support for things like the Neo Geo core or even an Amiga core like you get in the Mister, because it has the same Cyclone 5 FPGA chip at its core. So it's perfectly capable of running those systems. But I understand from Analog's point of view, for the sake of simplicity, they don't want to have to support an overly complicated system. They're just focusing on those Game Boy systems, the Atari Lynx, the Game Gear, without overly complicating things. So it's not for me. It's not for me as a hacker. It's for someone who just wants to pick up and play. And I respect what they've done with it.
Where do you stand on the ritual part of retro gaming? You know, there's a lot to be said for the actual act of taking a cartridge out of its case, out of its box, sliding it into a system and powering it on. How important is that to you?
When it comes to cartridges, that's very important to me. I think that's a huge part of the whole experience. When it comes to cassette tapes, which were very popular here in the UK, it gets old fast. It's great to put a ZX Spectrum tape in and listen to it loading once, twice, three times, it starts to get a bit boring when you're waiting 10, 15 minutes for a game to load. But cartridges, absolutely. I think they're a wonderful thing to collect and a great experience to slot them in and enjoy them just as you used to. So I don't know if I'll be buying one myself, but there's actually no way for me to buy one right now because they've completely sold out of those pre-orders. So look to the show notes for links to the website where that pre-order was, and hopefully they'll have them back in stock soon if that interests you.
Neil, speaking of cheaper alternatives to handheld gaming devices, there is a new system on the horizon, the PAL Kitty Q90. This story was shared in our show Reddit by EOC Phantom. Adam Patrick Murray on IBG Connect reports that this is the successor to the Pocket Go. So this is a system that's around $30-$35, and it is a straight up ROM player. So this is one of these things that you get if you have a collection of ROMs that you have, of course, ripped yourself from your own cartridges that you own.
And completely legally.
Right. And you take all of your games for all of your systems with you. These normally emulate the standard fare, all of the 8-bit consoles, going into the 16-bit consoles with greater or lesser degrees of accuracy. The market has been somewhat flooded with these over the course of the past few years, and what is shocking to me is how the price continues to fall while the quality, if not going up, remains somewhat steady. This thing is the successor to the Pocket Go, and if you're familiar with the Pocket Go, this just has a slightly larger footprint, a larger screen, and an easily replaceable battery. So it wins out over its predecessor in that regard. However, for some reason, they've decided to make the buttons a little bit more mushy. They don't have that clicky feel of the original Pocket Go. And for some reason, they've decided to put the speakers right where you put your fingers. So instead of putting the speakers at the bottom of the console so that they play downward, almost like a cell phone, they are right behind where your hands are. So that's not good. And having a bigger screen is good when you increase the pixel density, but when you don't, it just makes the screen a little bit more blurry. And that's what they've done here. They've increased the size of the screen, but they have not increased the pixel density. So it will not look as sharp as the original Pocket Go. So this thing is available for $36 at palkitty.com. Now, and something that I'm sure was unintentional, PalKitty is spelled differently on the website than the actual company name itself. The company name itself is spelled with two D's. The URL is powkidy.com. Oops.
That's Neil, the sign of a quality product.
That's right. So Neil, have you messed around with a lot of these Asian emulation portable systems?
Yes, I have messed around with a lot of them, usually for an average of about 45 seconds before I put them down again, because the mushy buttons and D-pad that you've described there is such a common thing, such a low build quality, so cheap to produce. And yes, you can have a bit of fun with them, maybe if you're playing an old NES game, Contra, something like that. It's fun for a few minutes, but it's not something that you would use a lot as a dedicated gamer. It's in a completely different league to that analog pocket that we've just described. And the screen is an important factor. The analog pocket has nearly a full HD 1080p screen in something the size of a Game Boy, which is, you know, we're talking about a premium cell phone quality screen. That's what we're talking about there. It's a completely different league to this. But that's not to say that you won't get $36 worth of value out of it. I need to see more about this.
What do you look for most in a handheld, just in general, when you are shopping around for something that you actually want to use for an extended period of time? What's most important for you?
It has to be the input. It has to be how the input feels, the ergonomics of it, because a slight sharp edge, as you've described, it can just kill the whole experience for you. You need to be immersed in the game that you're playing through those controls, and you need to do it in such a way that you never even think about it. You never think about the fact that you're holding this device. It just responds to your commands So yeah, controls definitely high on the list.
Yeah, I agree with you. I feel like the way that the unit sits in my hands is paramount, because it doesn't matter how good the screen looks or even how good the buttons respond. If my hand is cramping up after 5 minutes of holding the thing, it's a no-go for me. I still prefer the PlayStation Portable, the PSP. I still think is the king of the handhelds as far as what can play retro games now. I still go back to that, even though there are lots of options now with better screens. The PSP is still number one for me. How about you? What do you go to play your retro games on the go?
I have a PSP right next to me, as well as a PS Vita, and I completely agree. They sit in the hand beautifully. The emulators that have come out for it are fantastic. It's powerful enough to really push some of the 16-bit machines and beyond. So you can get a really good experience with the PSP, I think. Yeah, so that would be my choice. I'm there with you.
So anyway, if you want to find out more about the PowKitty Q90, the Pocket Go Q90, you can check out POWKIDY.com.
So would you believe it? Myst has had a demake for the Apple II computer. This comes courtesy of coder Vince Weaver, who's created a demake of Myst, which, remember, the Apple II is a system from 1977, and it's being made to run a game which is famous for its use of the capacity of a CD-ROM and for helping to popularize that format. You'll need a 48K Apple II or compatible to play it, 64K of memory if you want that served up with sound effects, and it also supports something called the Mockingbird sound card, so that you will get the intro theme if you've got that sound card installed. It's quite the spectacle if you see the screenshots of it. Really, really interesting project there from Vince.
This is one that I am really attracted to. I think the concept of demakes is something that should be much more explored by people that are interested in coding for these old machines, instead of making, you know, the 15,000th shoot 'em up clone or a platformer that is sort of substandard. Taking a game like Myst or a game like Portal, I know I've seen some Portal demakes, and what you're doing is you're boiling them down to the bare essence of what makes the game fun when you do a demake, and that's the whole sort of that's the whole positive side of retro gaming in general, is strip away the fancy graphics and get down to the bare metal of the fun factor. And this is one that I think really works out well for the Apple II in particular, because the Apple II is not really known for its great control options in terms of action games. You're basically limited to the keyboard or one of those Kraft analog sticks, which don't really respond well to a lot of games with fast action. Sorry, Apple II fans, just telling you like it is. I am really interested to play this thing. I actually have an Apple IIe sitting beside me here in the studio, and I will definitely fire it up once it comes out.
Well, you're certainly more of an authority than me on the Apple II, coming from the land where it was so popular. It wasn't quite so big over here in the UK. But it's interesting what you say about the programmer there, because creating demakes, you know, a good programmer isn't necessarily a good game designer. So It takes that whole problem off of his hands. And Vince has done an incredible job. He's reduced this down to 3 140K floppies. He's traced all of the scenes from the CD-ROM painstakingly into the Apple II, and it retains all of the locations from the original game. Nothing has been lost out on it here, and it's really quite nice to look at. He's chosen to use a really low resolution screen mode. It's just 40 by 48 pixels, but that gives him the ability to use 15 colors. So it's quite chunky, and it gives an almost teletext or Prestel-like view of the Myst world. But if you squint a bit and stand back, it does work quite well. So, John, I'm pleased to hear that you're going to give this a go. Maybe we'll see it on your YouTube channel at some point. We can see it in action.
That's right. That's right. Whenever this thing comes out, I will be streaming it over on our Twitch channel and putting it up on the Amigos Retro Gaming YouTube channel.
Fantastic. And would you believe it, Vince, who programmed this, did it to take his mind off of his other demake project, which was to demake Another World for the Apple II. So he's a very busy guy. Well done, Vince.
Well done. Neil, our next story comes to us from Reddit user Paul, a.k.a. Hermsky, and this is about the Open Amiga Sampler. So a UK-based group of developers have introduced the Open Amiga Sampler, a new open-source parallel port sampler. Here's what the developers have to say about the project. This project is a clone of the typical low-budget sampler design that flooded the market in the late 1980s and early 1990s. They're often referred to as carts, but they're actually not cartridges. They're usually small 25-pin parallel port dongles whose circuit boards and connectors are housed in the type of plastic shell that systems like the C64 and VIC-20 used as cartridge housing. But some manufacturers called them cartridges, and we've been calling them carts for decades, so we'll stick with that. So these are something that I've never seen before. I had no idea that there were cartridge. I mean, they really do look like cartridges. If you look at the GitHub page in the show notes, these things look a lot like a cartridge for a Commodore 64. They range in size from something small like that, and then the largest ones look almost like the A520, the RF adapter for the Amiga 500. I am interested in how these things actually perform. I've done a little bit of sampling in my time, but nothing on retro computers. Have you ever messed around with sampling before on the Amiga, Neil?
As you've been describing this product, it's inspired me to reach up to a shelf next to me and grab something called a TechnoSound Turbo, which I have here, which is precisely that. It's a cartridge-based sampler that you plug into the back of the Amiga. It was a very popular one back in the day, and I would have used this back then with Octamed. Now, my Amiga 500 didn't have a hard disk, so I was dependent on saving anything that I sampled onto a floppy disk, which ran out of space pretty quickly. But I did use it, and I was impressed with it at the time, and I'm really pleased to see that these guys are bringing it back to life and making sure this capability continues to exist for the Amiga.
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why you want to keep a real Amiga kicking around. There are so many great alternatives for the casual fan to get into using an Amiga, whether it's a Raspberry Pi or the new FPGA boards like the Unamiga. But as far as I know, none of them have an option for attaching any kind of device to a parallel port because they just don't have them. So this is one reason to keep your original hardware around if you want to get into the authentic sampling game. And if you want to read more, you can check out the article in the show notes over at synthtopia.com.
Some sad news next, John. It's that the computer mouse co-inventor has died at the ripe age of 91. His name is Bill English. He was an inventor born on your side of the pond in Kentucky, and he studied electrical engineering, and then he built the first computer mouse in 1963 alongside colleague Doug Engelbart. Together, they were working on some very early computer concepts. First of all, we should talk about what it looks like, because it is recognizable as a mouse, I think. It's sort of a little wooden block with a single red button on the top. But noticeably, if you turn it over, instead of having a ball in the bottom, it's got two wheels at a 90 degree angle. So one is measuring sideways movement and one vertical movement. So, you know, it works in a very, very similar fashion to a modern mouse.
Right. If you think about the rollers that are inside one of the old ball mice, they pretty much do the same thing. I think that the only downfall of this mouse is that, as far as I can tell, it allows for no diagonal movement. But it is amazing that this thing was from 1963. Talk about being ahead of the curve.
Incredible, isn't it? And it was first shown off to the world in what's known as the mother of all demos. I imagine quite a few listeners are familiar with that. It's a famous tech demo from 1968, which also demonstrated, as well as the mouse, video conferencing, word processing, and a form of hyperlinks before we'd even entered the 1970s. So incredible forward-thinking man and part of an incredible team. Bill would go on to work at Xerox PARC, where he replaced the wheels in the mouse with a ball. And he was also credited there with creating the graphical user interface, or the WIMP as some know it. So a real pioneer in the field. He will be sorely missed. And I have to say, as morbid as it sounds, very sadly, the engineers who created these things, they are reaching an age now where they worked on projects that have an impact in our lives in the home. Whereas before, computing was such a new and expensive thing, they would have been working on things for the government or in military institutes or in universities. But now that first generation of pioneers that have directly affected us in the homes with mice, with, you know, home micros, they're starting to get of an age. They're not getting any younger. So it's so important to get the stories from them while we still can, I think.
Absolutely. If you are interested in reading more about Xerox PARC, I highly recommend the book. It's called Dealers of Lightning. This is a chronicle of all of the innovations that came out of that that Palo Alto Research Center. This was really the glory days of corporate-sponsored innovation, where so many things were developed in these corporate-sponsored research centers, where they would just basically pay creative people an insane salary to sit around and come up with stuff. It's a crazy concept to think about in this day and age, but in the 60s and 70s, these idea houses really put out tons of technology that we still use today.
Yeah, I second that. I was given that very book for Christmas. Dealers in Lightning is a fantastic book. So anyone who's interested should go out and grab that. Thoughts, of course, for Bill's family. And Bill famously said that he never got rich off of the invention of the mouse. He created it, but the company he worked for patented it. So he didn't make a huge amount of money off of it. And because it was created so early in the 60s, the patent expired in 1987, so by the time our home computers were getting the processing power to actually make use of a graphical user interface with a mouse, the patent had expired, so anyone could create it. So Bill didn't get rich quick off of the mouse.
Neil, our last story comes to us from Indie Retro News. There is a new version, a new port, if you will, of Elite on the horizon, and it's for a system that you might not expect. Rauch Kornmann is working on a port of Elite to the Vectrex console. Are you familiar with the Vectrex, Neil?
I am familiar with the Vectrex. I've had the pleasure of playing on it recently at a computer museum. I don't have one myself, but if you ever get the chance to stand in front of one and use it, it is a mind-blowing machine. You just can't capture what it looks like with a camera or a YouTube video. You have to get yourself in front of one.
Yeah, if you are not familiar with the Vectrex, it is an all-in-one console that includes a vector monitor. So it's basically, if you can picture a rectangular, set on its end, vector monitor with a joystick attached to it, that is what the Vectrex is. And it's a monocolor phosphor vector monitor that comes with overlays, just like the original Odyssey did, where you put the overlay on and that gives you the illusion of color. Obviously, the Vectrex games are really wireframe only. There's no way to display anything other than straight lines on a vector monitor, and that makes it a perfect candidate for a game like Elite, of course made famous on the BBC Micro with the wireframe graphics. Later versions of Elite that came out on various systems tried to overcome this and put, you know, shaded graphics into the system. But for a lot of people, they prefer the BBC Micro version because of the wireframe graphics and the speed that it allowed you to play, because drawing, of course, lines on the screen is much less CPU intensive than drawing objects. Neil, what was your first experience with Elite?
It would have been on an Amstrad CPC, so one of those first 8-bit ports, and also on an Acorn Electron. So that was the little brother to the BBC Micro. They ported it to the Electron. Just thinking about this, I think it will look fantastic on a Vectrex because of those wireframe graphics, as you've described. But the Vectrex is not known as a system to have much processing power. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see if any features are lost along the way in this conversion.
Yeah, I've seen a couple videos of this thing in action, and it's at a very early stage. One thing that gives me hope is that thanks to the NES port, they have figured out a way to move through the menus and all that without the need of a keyboard. And of course, controlling your ship is all done through the joystick on Elite. So I have high hopes for this one. I hope it comes out. I know that Aaron has a Vectrex multi-cart. So if we could somehow load this into that, it would be fantastic. I'd love to give Elite a go on the Vectrex. There's nothing like a vector monitor in terms of it's got brightness so high it almost sears your eyes, but in a good way.
In a good way. Do we know if there'll be a physical release of this?
That has not been announced yet. I really hope there is. I think that the creator would really have a hit on his hands if he decided to produce a physical release.
Today's episode of This Week in Retro comes thanks to our partners at Anchor FM. Whether you're new to the game or you have an existing successful podcast, Anchor FM offer a home where you can extend your audience and find new sponsorship opportunities to make it the most successful podcast it can be.
That's right, Neil. We love Anchor. and that's why we use them to host This Week in Retro. You should check them out at anchor.fm for more info.
So that concludes our first show of This Week in Retro, the very first of the podcast series. You guys are here right at the very beginning. I hope you stick around to be a part of it and come back again next week.
This Week in Retro is brought to you by you, the listener. Stories featured in this podcast are suggested and voted up or down on our show subreddit at reddit.com/r/thisweekinretro.
And we'll see you next time on This Week in Retro for more up-to-date news for out-of-date tech.